And let me tell you something. For the first time in my adult life, I am proud of my country.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Now is our mercenary geologist, Mickey Folk. Mickey, give him the website and your Twitter handle.
Website is mercenarygeologist.com. Twitter is at mercenarygeo.
And the reason he got mercenary geologist, he says all geologists are mercenaries. But he's also our expert on all these earthquakes. Now, Mickey, back up. Few months or a few weeks ago, we were talking about a number of earthquakes. We've seen the big ones that you were forecasting. Now, last week we got a relatively, what was it, a 7.5, 7.5 or something off the coast of Mexico. We've had a 9 after that earthquake swarm in off the coast of Chile. Is this an unusually active earthquake season?
I don't think so. You know, we've the one in Chile actually was an 8.1 or 8.2. A 9 would be like the third largest ever, and we certainly didn't have one of those. But we average, and I will tell you, I'm not forecasting. I'm just using statistical probabilities in this regard. We average 15 greater than 7.0. worldwide every year, and we average 1 8.0 every year. So, but they happen randomly. For instance, in 2007, we had 4 8.0s, and sometimes we'll go a year or two without an 8.0. But averaged out, that's the way it works. Recently, the one we're going to talk about today was 100 kilometers northwest Acapulco in the Mexican state of Guerrero, and that was a 7.2.
Now, is this all part of the Ring of Fire?
It certainly is. Mexico is one of the most earthquake or seismically active parts of the world, and it has to do in southern Mexico. The Cocos Plate is subducting under the North American Plate. And if you go just north of there up to, it's quite a ways, actually, but up to the Gulf of California and Baja, that area of Sonora, western Mexico, at that point, the Pacific Plate is subducting under the North American plate, but it's also complicated by a spreading center in the Gulf of California, just south of there, called the East Pacific Rise. So we've got these three plates, and they're colliding and moving apart. And so this has resulted in lots of big earthquakes in this part of the world, and also lots of big volcanoes.
So a subduction zone, a subduction zone in Azera is an area where one plate is going underneath the other?
That's correct. When oceanic plate is subducting under crustal or under continental plates, and the reason that happens is because oceanic rocks are basalt, and they're heavier than continental rocks, which are mainly granite. So they just float and sink, basically.
What makes the Ring of Fire so particularly active compared to other subduction zones?
The Ring of Fire is where most of the subduction is ongoing in the world. And so it stretches, as we've talked about before, from Tierra del Fuego or even south of there towards Antarctica. And it goes all the way up to Alaska and comes across Japan and our eastern Russia, Japan, Indonesia, Philippines, New Zealand. So you circumscribe that, and that distance is a long ways, and it basically covers about half the world. We have other subduction zones. We have continental collision in India and China, which accounts for the Himalayas. We have the East Pacific rise. We have lots of stuff going on in the Caribbean, but this is the most active part of the planet. For instance, where this earthquake happened, the Cocos Plate is subducting at a rate of 6.5 centimeters a year. For metrically challenged Americans, that would be something about 2.5 inches.
But why the Ring of Fire? Why is that so active, and then the one that is out here where I am is so inactive? I mean, what makes...
Well, the one, you know, the subduction, the continental collision that happened that pushed up the Appalachians happened 300 million years ago. It's not active anymore. So it has to do with continental breakup and where those plates move around. And this is where they happen to be right now. In 250 million years, it'll be some sort of different geometry.
Now I
can't answer why it is. It just is.
I got you. And I like the way you describe it. The landmass is floating on a conveyor belt. And it's floating on a bed of lava underneath us, correct?
Yeah, essentially that's it. I mean, it's not liquid lava. It's not magma. It's volcanic rocks. But basically, there are currents in the mantle that move the upwelling magma, and it spreads out, and it's got to go someplace because you have to conserve volume. The Earth's not going to get bigger or smaller. It's not expanding or shrinking. So things have to move around.
You had told me previously that we are ultimately going to see a few hundred million years from now yet another supercontinent.
It's predicted that in 200 to 250 million years from now, our seven continents will be back into two supercontinents, and that would include the Americas, Europe, and Asia in one huge continent, and then Antarctica and South and Australia in the other big continent.
So are we, like Europe, and we can all look at the map of South America and see that it fits nicely into East Africa. I mean, you can tell.
Yeah, and it's all going to go back together and fit nicely again. There'll be some permutations, some differences between the last one, Pangaea, but it's basically all going to fit back together as pieces in a puzzle.
So are we, in the case of North America, are we moving westward? Or are they moving? We would have to be...
Well, it's relative. So if we're moving northwestward, then somebody else is moving southeastward. So, you know, it's all relative. There's nothing sitting still. There's nothing in place. So saying whether this one moved or that one, it's all about relativity.
Well, I misspoke. I mean, are we moving east and they're moving west, or is that... I mean, I would assume...
Well, basically, the North American plate is moving west with respect to the Pacific plate.
I got you.
Actually, more northwest with respect to the Pacific plate. But neither of them's anchored. They're both moving. It just depends on your frame of reference.
So is all the landmass moving all the time?
Well, the continent as a whole is moving, but for instance, you know, I live in the Rio Grande Rift in New Mexico, and we're a spreading center. So we are an incipient spreading center, and in a few million years, where I live right now could be equal to the Gulf of California now. So it's all moving as a mass, but it does not. But there's perturbations, there's movement within that mass. For instance, the New Madrid Fault, whenever that moves, that's in the middle of the continent on something called the Real Foot Rift.
So what we think of as a landmass, like North America, that's actually made up of several of these plates that we just, I guess the most obvious is out there in California where you can see the fault line, but we have other fault lines.
Well, we're all the North American plate, but we have many faults within that. So it's so it gets jumbled around a bit all the time. You know, it's like pieces of a puzzle where there's big pieces and little pieces, and they move around a bit. And, you know, the North American continent, the North American plate, is composed of many different geological terrains that were sutured or welded onto the continent as it was being built. So, for instance, before the Appalachian Mountains came up, the Piedmont and the Gulf or the eastern coast of where you live, or even towards South Carolina, that was not part of the continent back before the Appalachians were formed. It was welded on.
Before you and I started doing this segment together, I had back when we were mainly talking about investing. I had done a piece on the Appalachians, the Smoky Mountain area, and one of the things that I was surprised to learn is that a lot of the vegetation that was deposited there actually came from glacial activity.
Yeah, I don't know how far the glaciers got, but they certainly didn't get down to Atlanta. The last glaciation did not reach that far, but certainly New York City was glaciated. Washington, D.C., I think, if memory serves, was kind of the edge of the ice sheet. And so south of there is no evidence of recent glaciation.
Is there a cycle to the glaciation?
There is a cycle somewhere 15,000 to 40,000 years. If people want to know a little bit more about that, they could go on my website and look at that. A piece we did on the radio, which spawned a musing called Geological Catastrophes Waiting to Happen, or The End of the World as We Know It. And we address quaternary glaciation in that piece. We are in an intraglacial period right now between glaciers, and we would expect that somewhere in around 15,000 years we will have major continental glaciation again.
You can go to mercenarygeologist.com. That's what he's talking about. And then you get to see old Mickey on there. And it looks like, is that the Grand Canyon behind you?
No, that picture on my homepage is a place in the Tutagon of northern B.C. called Tough Peak. And it's a place I worked in 2006 on a gold project. Prospect in the summer, and it never really gets summer up there, so it's quite a ways north. I think the latitude's about 58 degrees north, something like that.
That far north, it looks like, just to a layman like myself, that they have the red rock that we're familiar with when we look at parts of Arizona. Is that an accurate observation?
No, those in that picture, that's a big glacial valley behind me in the distance, and you can see glaciated peaks up in the far distance. But all that red down there, this photograph was taken in mid-August, and that's all the scrub that has already turned, and 2 weeks before that it was completely green.
Yeah, I'm enjoying going on your website. So we're leaving the last ice age right now, aren't we?
Yes, we are. We're still recovering from that last ice age.
And once this retreat is completed, I mean, I know the global warming people are going to blame all this on global warming, but what's the cycle that causes these glaciers to expand and retreat? And why are we in a period where it's retreating?
I have no idea. I don't think those questions are easily answered. All we know is that the Earth is warming. We would expect that coming out of from a glaciated period 10,000 years ago, and we expect to be in a period of warming for a while, and then it's going to get colder again. But this whole glacier ice age phenomenon in the Quaternary now, going on 2 million years, is quite an anomaly. Earth is for the most part has been much hotter throughout its history, and so we only know of a few glacial periods, and the last one before the Quaternary of any significance was 700 million years ago, and they call that Snowball Earth, and the entire Earth was frozen. All the water on the Earth was frozen.
Mickey, I had asked you when I'd gotten a couple of listener emails about these particular fish that you only see when normally they're way deep, and when these things surfaced, it was a harbinger of an earthquake to come in an area which a week later we saw one, but you're not necessarily a...
Now, I haven't seen the article, but be specific here, Alan. You know, Mexico's a huge country. Was this... number one, there is no scientific evidence ever been produced that animals can predict earthquakes, and there have been many attempts by scientists doing research to ferret this out. There is no evidence that this happens at all. Mexico is a big place. There is no ability of man or humans to predict earthquakes. And so the fact that they see some unknown fish, which normally occupies deep water, surfacing in some unknown place, presumably on the west coast of Mexico, which stretches for something on the order of 4,000 kilometers, just doesn't hold. It's pseudoscience. You know, I put it right up there with astrology and predicting weather with a farmer's almanac and old wives' tales. And there's lots of pseudoscience goes along. And if people want to get some background on this, go to Wikipedia and research it and look at what the USGS says about their attempts to do research on animal predictability of earthquakes. It just doesn't hold water.
The fish in question here is the oar fish. Well, all right, what about ants? I think I remember seeing...
Well, you can go on Wikipedia and you can see research, which I looked at this morning about ant colonies, biologists studying ant colonies, and earthquakes happened and they saw no anomalous behavior.
So we don't look at the way the birds fly or anything like that to predict.
No, now certainly if there are foreshocks before a major earthquake, for instance, that Chileno big earthquake was preceded by a couple of weeks of earthquake swarms, 1 week over 300 small earthquakes, and certainly when those things happen, people will feel them and animals will feel them and people will act differently and animals will act differently.
Mickey, are they making
it? We just cannot predict earthquakes, and I'm convinced we never will be able to.
Well, that was going to be my question. Are we making any progress towards earthquake prediction?
No, absolutely not. What we do have now is more scientific instruments. We have GPS, we have seismographs, we have tsunami warnings. You know, Mexico City has this early earthquake warning. They had 71 seconds after the earthquake hit in Guerrero, they had 71 seconds to react before it was felt in Mexico City. So they have earthquake warning systems. We have GPS, which can measure earth movements. So we do have the ability to know when volcanoes are starting to accumulate magma. We have all this instrumentation which would help us say this is a seismically active area. But the ability to predict when and where an earthquake's going to happen is not going to happen. That's pseudoscience, too.
Would that also apply to volcanoes?
Yes.
I mean, like, for example, I mean, when Yellowstone decides it's going to blow, I mean, will we have any notice?
Possibly. We likely will have some notice that the magma body is moving around, but the idea that you will be able to predict when it's going to happen and how big it is going to be, is that's not going to happen.
Or any of them, Mount Punatuna.
Well, Mount St. Helens. We knew it was going to erupt. I mean, it erupted for a period of time before it finally blew, but no one knew it was going to blow and when it was going to blow, and no one knew how big it was going to be. I mean, you know, these we alluded a bit earlier about this string of active and dormant volcanoes that stretches across from west to east, completely across southern south central Mexico. There are three giant volcanoes there, stratovolcanoes greater than 5,000 meters high. That's 16,500 feet high. Popocatépetl was erupted in 2010. So we are aware that these are active volcanoes, and but predicting when exactly they're going to erupt, Iztaccíhuatl puts out smoke and steam all the time. And, you know, these two volcanoes are within visual distance of Mexico City. So we just don't know. The Earth's a dynamic place, and if people think we'll ever be able to predict what's going to happen, I think we're fooling ourselves.
The same dynamics that cause the earthquakes are also what's at work with volcanoes?
Yes, it's all has to do with plate tectonics.
Mickey, basically
the subduction zone, as those rocks get buried deeper and deeper within the subduction zone, as they get, and these are relatively low, low angle fault. So as you go continental, you get to the point where it gets hot enough that you start making magmas, and that's where the volcanoes sprout up.
I wish I had your knowledge of geology. I bet, you know, I because of my years in the gutter guard business, I can see gutter guards on houses at night.
Yeah.
All right. So,
well, you know, I would encourage anybody that's listening, and you too, Alan, that most universities and a lot of even community colleges offer non-credit geology 101 courses for laymen. For instance, they do this here at the University of New Mexico all the time. So you can take a non-credit continuing education class on geology and learn about this stuff, and they'll take you to the field, they'll take you to Stone Mountain and whatever else you got in Georgia that's geologically interesting, the Blue Ridge Mountains and the Ridge and Valley Province and the Piedmont and etc. And you can learn a little bit about this stuff.
Well, I remember eighth grade earth science, but not and I remember my teacher. Hey, but
well, when I went to college or to high school or junior high, they didn't even have earth science. We just had science.
Well,
general science.
Well, I think I'm probably a little bit older than you now. I just turned 60. How about you?
Well, I'm 62.
Well, you're looking good for 62. This is Mickey.
Well, so are you, my man.
Well, I appreciate that. I don't know if I'd rather be. First of all, you look good bald-headed, and I think I would have a hard time seeing you with hair. But if you ever notice in our age group, you're either bald-headed or you're white-headed.
That's true.
Well, Mickey, it's always fun talking about this stuff. This is Mickey Folt. Mickey is the mercenarygeologist.com. You can go to his website, mercenarygeologist.com. He's got all kinds of good stuff on there. One of these days we'll get back to talking investments, but which is how Mickey and I got started. And then we realized that politically we were aligned, a couple of wild-eyed libertarian free market types, and then we got wandered into this interesting topic of geology, and the rest is history, right, Mickey?
Well, I think so. So, and then geological history, it's a speck of a moment in time.
Mickey, it's always a pleasure, buddy. Thanks a lot for your time today.
All right. Thanks a lot, Alan.
All right.
My pleasure.
You too.